I respect that at least you're trying, and I want to be a part of that. Doesn't get any better than that.
Welcome to Home Starts Here, a podcast from the South Dakota State University Extension Community Vitality Team. We seek out the individuals, businesses, and ideas that are sparking vibrant communities across South Dakota. We sit down with rural change makers, striving to understand their place in the local ecosystem.
Human capital is the skills, knowledge, and experience possessed by an individual or population viewed in terms of their value or cost to a society. All people have some level of human capital they can contribute to their community. Think about odd skills you have or something you experience that most others haven't. But sometimes finding a way to leverage human capital in a community is difficult. Today you'll hear from Lauren Stiggs about how the community of Roslyn, South Dakota came together and leveraged his unique knowledge of vinegar and life experiences, an empty building in town, local assets, and local knowledge to create a museum to not only put their town on the map, but also to excite the community and teach life skills to the next incoming generations. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Home Starts Here. I am Kara Harders, a Community Vitality Field Specialist, and today I am here with Lawrence Diggs. Lawrence, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Lawrence Diggs. I'm a resident of Roslyn, South Dakota, home of the International Vinegar Museum, and I came here from San Francisco in 1989.
So Roslyn is an interesting place to end up and to stay ended up in. And what kind of made you come here and settle and want to stay?
When I originally was introduced to Roslyn, I had been looking for a kind of a place to do my writing and thinking and things like that, just be away from the hubbub of the city. And I was just looking for that kind of home, like a home away from home, kind of like people have second home, lake homes or something like that. Because I had been in radio and TV enough in San Francisco that, you get a certain amount of notoriety and then you notice how that's not always the best thing when everybody knows you. And then also everybody feels like they should be able to tell you how to live your life. So you always feel under a microscope. So I wanted to find some place where people didn't know who I was and just sort of like, you know, like I could live quietly. And so I had been looking around for about 4 years for a place down in Texas, in the Four Corners, up in Oregon and Northern California, all kinds of places. I was looking for some kind of little hideaway cabin or something like that. Mm-hmm. And one day a real estate agent called me and said, "Hey, we got this place in Roslyn, South Dakota. That's pretty remote, you know."
Yes, it is.
And the bonus was that it had a fire extinguisher, a fire hydrant about half a block from my house. And that's important because insurance companies like to hear that, you know? So, yes, and also they like to hear that the town is active as opposed to some of those cabins, you know, like in Idaho where you're way up in the mountains or something like everything kind of fit together. But what really made the difference is while I was looking at the house, one of the neighbors came over and he said, "Oh, are you going to buy this house?" You know, and I'm thinking, well, not really. You know, I mean, I haven't decided yet. As I said to him, I haven't decided yet. He said, "Well, if you decide to buy it, you know, the people who left kind of left in a hurry. So it's probably kind of junky in there. And that's my pickup over there. If you want to use it, you know, just let the wife know so she knows the kids aren't messing with it." And I was really struck by that because the guy hadn't even asked me my name yet, but he was offering me to use his pickup, you know. And so coming from a place like San Francisco, that was like bizarre, you know, it's like somebody would do that. So I thought, okay, well, I don't know, you know, if this is the best place, but if I were to think of like, you know, a start, what would I be looking for more than this? You
right.
know, because you have neighbors who, you know, or at least that person who is like very open, that doesn't even know you yet. It doesn't matter. They just decide, "Oh yeah, you want to live here? Okay, great." You know? So it turns out that most of the other people who lived in Roslyn treated me kind of like the same way. Like I had been there all my life and, you know, and I just showed up and people like just sort of treated me, like I'd been, like I grew up there. And for example, you know, they had like, I'm Buddhist and the town was pretty much known to be Lutheran because that was the Lutheran church was there. And there was a couple of evangelicals, but mostly it was like Lutherans. And
wild and crazy evangelicals.
Oh, gosh. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Wilder than you can imagine. One of the things that was interesting is that, you know, that they had a men's group that met on the first Sunday of every month. Mm-hmm. And if I wasn't there, they would call me. You know, I'd never been in a place where the people call you and say, hey, how come you're not at coffee, or how come you're not at, you know, are you sick or something like that?
Right.
So that kind of interaction with people just sort of made you feel like they already have decided that you belong here. Right. And I hadn't been there, you know, more than a month or two, you know. So I just feel like after I was there, and when I originally came there, I hadn't really planned to stay. It was just like, you know, my business is all over the world. Doesn't matter where I leave from. And, you know, San Francisco is a place I know. I get things done there. But it's nice to get away sometimes and be able to think thoughts and just sort of be quiet. You know, that was my idea. Well, of course, I've since recreated my own hell. You know, by doing, you know, just by things I've done, I've like recreated that same kind of everybody knows who you are. And
when you said that in the beginning that you were leaving to get away from everybody knowing you.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like, oh, that won't end well. That will not end well, you know. And but I have to say, it's been more exciting than what I would have been doing in San Francisco, and more exciting and more interesting than just sitting there and using it as a crash pad, you know, a summer crash pad. So I have no regrets at all. I mean, I'm very happy with the move and the things that I've been doing here. Yeah, it's a good place.
Yeah. Awesome. That's great to hear. I think, you know, so often we hear that, you know, a newer, smaller town might not be very inviting. And I think that, you know, there's examples all over the place that a lot of people are willing to let the guy who might buy the house next door use his truck if he needs to.
Exactly. and offer it. Yeah. I didn't ask him, hey, could I use your truck? Or, you know, is there somebody around here with a truck that I could borrow? And I come there with a van, you know, so I could, you know, I mean, it was doable with the van.
Right.
But he had a pickup truck and he was, you know, and it was his way to say, hey, welcome to the town.
Right.
You know,
that's really cool. So you mentioned, I think in the beginning, or maybe I just knew this about you already, that you have a background in the vinegar world. How did you find yourself in vinegar?
Okay, so my first career was in radio and TV. I did that for about 10 years. And then I went from there into, you could say, kind of emergency medicine. It was being a paramedic, but I actually went on to design medical systems and stuff like and equipment and stuff. So I was in that kind of world. And in that world, I discovered that most people were sick because they ate wrong. And I should say, back up and say, I left radio because I felt like I was just talking about problems, but I wasn't doing anything. There was no dirt underneath my fingernails. So I wasn't working in the garden. I was just like looking at pictures of the gardens and talking about and buying seeds and equipment, but never planting anything.
Right. Yeah.
So I just felt like, that's kind of empty. That's an empty feeling. You know, I want to do something else. So little by little, I decided, well, you know, I want to get into this medical thing. That feels more interesting. And paramedics is like something you can get instant gratification. You actually do something, you know, when you see somebody bleeding and you stop the bleeding, or like you're working on their heart attack or babies being born or something like that, that you have a sense that you're actually doing something. There's a life there. It's an adrenaline rush, but it's one that's made up out of, at least you can give yourself the illusion that you're making a difference in the world, you know? Well, after I had spent some time in West Africa setting up emergency medical service there, I realized that most of the people that we were doing things for and with, they were sick because they a lot of it was because they ate wrong, you know, because you could see in the marketplace a lot of the junk that mm-hmm. people, and I don't mean like junk food, I mean like food that was mislabeled or like poorly manufactured. And it's easy to think, oh, well, that happens in Africa. But then when you come back, you realize, oh, they're playing the same tricks on people in this country as they're playing in Africa. They're just practicing in Africa, but then they come back here and do the same stuff, you know. So I thought, oh, I need to do something in food. And I started studying food science. And I was doing, I had to do a paper in one of the food science classes. And it was like a term paper. And so I decided, well, this professor, he's like really, I mean, he really knows his stuff. But I noticed that he had talked about wine, cheese, beer, and stuff, but he hadn't said anything about vinegar. So it's almost like if I do a paper on wine, this guy's going to be nitpicking this paper to death.
Right.
Now he knows may, it. That's right. Now he may know a lot about vinegar, but the fact that he didn't include it in a particular, you know, in the coursework, mm-hmm. he didn't include it except to say, yeah, if you make this wine wrong, it turns to vinegar, you know, because it was a fermentation class. And so I thought, oh, maybe I should do this vinegar thing. Well, I went to the library to get books and papers and stuff. It turns out that at that time, there was no book in the English language in print on vinegar. And
when was this?
This was in 1984.
That's crazy, because you think vinegar is kind of a staple cooking food, a common good.
Everybody should be well versed in vinegar. You know what I mean? Because right. you know, when you try to think of like, well, there's so many things it's in. It's used in industry. It's used in medicine. It's used in food, of course. It's used in for preservation and altering cleaning proteins, products, cleaning. It's everywhere. Mm-hmm. Civilizations can almost be defined by how much vinegar they use. You will have a hard time finding an advanced society that doesn't use copious amounts of vinegar. That's just a statistical fact.
Okay, so what is different? What are the differences in a more developed society that uses more vinegar? How
does the vinegar makes a difference, right?
Yeah.
Well, it turns out that something I learned in middle school turns out to be the key, because the teacher said that the thing that distinguishes an advanced culture from one that's not so advanced is the amount of leisure time and discretionary income that country can distribute to its citizens. Mm-hmm. And what makes a difference, has made a difference in that in most of the world, is the ability to supply a reliable and steady supply of food. Because if you're always looking for food, you don't have time for science.
Right.
You don't have time for art. You don't have time for all the things that can make a society advance. So the first thing you have to do is to create a stable supply of food for your population, not just for a few people on the top, for everybody. Because if half your population dies of starvation, you're going to have a hard time even defending yourself against somebody else, mm-hmm. because you're always, you know, searching for food.
Exactly.
And also, you're going to be weak and sickly because you don't have food. So vinegar, it turns out, is a better preservative than the refrigerator. If you put something in vinegar, you can come back 10 years later and get it and eat it. And so cultures who develop large amounts of vinegar was able to equalize the distribution of food. So in the fall, they could store away food so that during the winter, when you couldn't find food, there was always food. It may not be the best tasting or something like that. And in some cases, as they learned to use vinegar, it became as tasty as the rest of the time, mm-hmm. right? So one of the things that killed people and weakened them most was bad drinking water and not having the ability to have a hydration supply. So it turns out that if you put even small amounts of vinegar in water, it will kill the bacteria that mostly makes people sick from diarrhea and stuff like that. In fact, it was such a known thing in the Roman world that the Roman soldiers could not drink water that didn't have vinegar in it. They had a drink called Posca, and that was water with vinegar and honey in it.
Okay.
And if you notice, the biblical story of Christ was the last thing that he consumed was vinegar.
Right.
Why did the Roman soldiers offer him vinegar? Well, the people who don't eat a lot of vinegar and don't know about Pascha will think that, oh, they were trying to even torture him more by giving him vinegar to drink.
Yeah, I always believed it was a slight.
Yes. It turned out that that was like a Coca-Cola to Roman soldiers. They had that was their pop. In fact, there was a whole industry making stuff that Pascha. There was a whole industry that made those, and they made it from the lees of beer. When they made beer, they took the lees that after they pressed that beer, mm-hmm. took those grains and they rehydrated it, and they made vinegar from that, and they added honey to that, and that was a kind of soft drink. Okay, So that made it. If you have those kinds of things just as part of the way you live, that gives you an edge over all the people who don't, because in between, you know, all the other things they have to do, well, the main thing they have to do is look for food.
Right.
And if you have not only food, but good food, your population is healthier. If you have safer drinking water so that people are not always battling diarrhea or some other stomach ailment, that gives you more time to think. You know, and if you have many people in your society that are also thinking collectively, that catapults you over the other people who don't have that.
By leaps and bounds, I would imagine.
Exactly.
That's a lot less to worry about.
Exactly. You have all the, you know, even if you have an extra hour every day to think about whatever you want to think about, that's huge if you use it. You know, a lot of people, they have it, but then they watch TV.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
But if you have that leisure time and the discretionary income, you're about as rich as you're ever going to be. That is the very definition of wealth. That is the difference between, that's what makes it so that countries and societies that use vinegar have that kind of advantage, especially before there was such thing as refrigeration and on-demand food supplies and stuff like that, you know.
Well, that's, I got my vinegar lesson for the day.
That's why we should have a vinegar industry in South Dakota. Yeah, especially now that we're getting more people making beer. This is a grain state. And just like in California, they have lots of wine vinegars. That should be a major industry in South Dakota, should be a malt vinegar, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we have all these different kind of grains we grow, and we could grow a lot more small grains. And all just so happens that many of those small grains are perfect for making vinegar, and they will make more flavorful, more interesting vinegars than most of the vinegars that people buy these days.
How did you transfer all of your knowledge and experience with vinegar into a museum? How did you make that jump?
Yeah. Okay, so I have been in South Dakota, in Roslyn, for about 10 years. And one of the things that, you know, in that time, you grow a sort of like a connection that you're part of the community. Whatever hurts on the far end of town hurts you, you mm-hmm. know, and you feel that directly because they're your friends, they're the people that you do things with. Your sense of well-being is directly tied to their sense of well-being. So as we started having people, like, they couldn't make a living in Roslyn, and so they were moving, or one thing or another, these small towns, they have a certain kind of critical mass, and then they start to implode because mm-hmm. there isn't the infrastructure to hold them together. So as that was happening, I and some of my friends realized, look, if this keeps going the way it's going, we're not going to have a town here pretty soon. This town is going to die before we do. And that's a thing, you know. So some of us got together and started talking about it, and we decided to have a town meeting, and we got people together to talk about what everybody was thinking and talking about, but they just never it just never coalesced into a movement.
No one wants to say it out loud either.
That's right. No one wants to be the first one to say they saw the spaceship. You know?
Right.
So when everybody keeps pretending there's no spaceship and there's no aliens, you know. But after we had that meeting, we agreed that we needed to do something, but people didn't know what to do. So it just so happens that I'm kind of a child of the 60s and 70s, and we did a lot of community organizing and trying to build our communities from, you know, from them imploding and actually being gentrified and taken away from us, really. And that's important because that gave me the advantage of deja vu. I had seen many of the same games that were played on inner city people being played on my neighbors. And I could recognize them because for these people, they were blindsided. But for me, I'm thinking, oh, that's what those guys did before. That's what they did to us. And we end up losing our whole community and being sort of like pushed out.
Right.
And so when I started looking at what was happening in South Dakota, it occurred to me that people who have a plan that their idea is 12 haciendas and two big towns. They see Rapid City and Sioux Falls and the rest of South Dakota is on these big haciendas. And if you're not part of this plantation, then you don't belong here. And whether they were planning that or not, their economic plans were centered around that. And you can, to me, it's still happening at an accelerated pace, that people are, all of the little towns, like you jerk their schools out and you say, oh, it doesn't matter. You know, it does matter because it's not just the school. The spirit of core of those little towns are around their school. They don't have the 49ers and the Vikings. Mm-hmm. What they do have is their high school, their high school football team. What they do have is the neighbors can go see the kids. That's where the kids get to know that the neighbors who care because they come to the games. You have your local school and you can go to the school and participate in the lives of the kids, you know, who live with you, as opposed to those kids spending most of their waking hours outside of your town and then you don't see them. They make friends in other towns and then pretty soon when they graduate, they're gone and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, I imagine it really loses the, you know, when we talk about towns kind of starting to die out and then the school leaves, is that kind of being the big thing? We always talk about it from the jobs that, oftentimes it's the jobs that are associated with losing it, but it's the sporting events or the kid not having the same connection to their hometown as they would.
That's right.
Absolutely.
And if you say it's the jobs, one, this is a capitalist country, so we really shouldn't be talking so much about jobs. We should be talking about enterprise. You know, I mean, it kind of bugs me that we in school, we talk about, oh, let's teach your kids to fill out a job application. Well, first teach him how to make a business plan. Because if he doesn't understand really how business works, what good is he to a business, really? You know, and every child should see themselves as a vendor, not as an employee. I bring something to this enterprise. I bring value to the enterprise. What is the value that I bring to the enterprise? And if I bring value to the enterprise, I should be compensated for the value that I bring to the enterprise. That needs to start in kindergarten. You know, I mean, to me, I'm a hope to die capitalist, but I'm not a monopoly capitalist. I'm not the kind of capitalist that thinks, to me, capitalism is the lubrication for the transfer of goods and services. It is not the goods and services. It is not the end point to make money. Money is the kind of the grease of the wheel for us to transfer goods and services between people. And the system, the capitalist system, is a way to do that, but it shouldn't be just to make money. In fact, making money should be a kind of a side thing. It's something that happens as a result of you transferring the goods and services that is of value to your fellow citizens. And for that, as a result of that, you get some benefit. Mm-hmm. If the whole thing is like, well, how can I just make the most money? Then why not be a pimp or a dope dealer? You know, we can have those kind of enterprises, repugnant enterprises, instead of ones that help people, because they often make more money for less work, you right. know? So to me, we should be, right from kindergarten, we should be instilling these ideas of capitalism as a way to transfer our goods and services in a way that makes it work for everybody. So if when I'm looking at how, you know, what should we be doing? I'm thinking, okay, well, what kind of businesses should we be having, you know, in Roslyn? What are the kind of things that we can do to give people place? How do we have our kids think of what kind of business could I do in Roslyn that I could trade the goods and service that I provide, that I can create while living in Roslyn, to the rest of the world and trade for something that they have that we don't have. Mm-hmm. That's the basis for trade.
It's what you want.
You know, that's what yeah. you want, right? So when I look at a small town like Roslyn, I look and I see the young people, and I'm thinking, you know, go get a good education, go see the world, but you got a golden spot here. You belong here. You know, in any other place, you're going to be a second class person. You know, like you move to New York, nobody knows your name, mm-hmm. you know. If you were here, you could go work someplace for a year, make a little money, you know, like a little nest egg, come back here and buy your house cash or build one for cash, you know, in some place. Like you get your degree at Lake Area Tech, you go on to, you get a degree in being a, let's say a dental technician, which is not, you know, this is not what you call your top of the line thing, but it pays enough.
It does.
It pays enough that you could live in Roslyn, commute for a couple of years to Watertown or someplace, buy your house cash. You no longer have a mortgage. You no longer have rent. You're set. Basically, you're set.
You're leaps and bounds ahead of a lot of
everybody, you know? Pretty yeah. much everybody else. Yeah. Because if at 25 or 30, you never have to pay a mortgage again and you never have to rent, you just double whatever salary, whatever. Go and do what you want now.
Yeah.
You know? When I, you know, coming from a place where that was kind of hard, you think, why would you walk away from this? You know, now a lot of kids would say to me, and they older people who were kids at one time and were living in Roslyn, and they come back to the Vinegar Museum and we'd have these conversations over the vinegar tasting bar. And I would ask them, well, you know, like what kind of business are you in? Oh, I'm a guy for a welding shop, or I have this kind of business. And so my next question is like, why couldn't you do a business like that in Roslyn? Why didn't you start or come back and do that business in Roslyn? Mostly out of curiosity. It wasn't a guilt trip. It was mm-hmm. just like, okay, help me out here. What did you see? Why did you have to go there and do it? Couldn't you have done that here? And they said, you know, it really wasn't the money. It was the fact that as a kid, if I wanted to have an earring in my ear, everybody thought they had something to say about it. And not just something to say about it. If I didn't take it out, there was like social consequences for it.
Right. Right. Know? Absolutely.
You know, I couldn't do it. I couldn't, you know, now I don't have an earring in my ear. But at that time, I wanted to like find out who I was. I wanted to try things. I wanted to be somebody else. And beside, if I felt like if I went to some place and I brought my significant other back, they had to get approval. So it's, mm-hmm. it's sort of like, well, you know, if I married somebody that I thought would work out in Roslyn, then maybe I would come back. But if I, you know, if I married somebody who, you know, they have different ideas, and I know my aunts and uncles and, well, pretty much, and your cousins, and that's pretty much who lives. You know, if I know all of these people, and I know how they, you know, because I've been listening to them over the barbecues for years, and I know that just half of the people, they think this way, this paper, but I also know that these people could be miserable, you know. Mm-hmm. Now, myself, I'm thinking, oh, I think you could have worked around that, but they didn't believe that.
Right.
You know, they, but, you know, I mean, like, I'm, you know, I'm kind of a living testimony that people can from outside make it in a place like that. But their kids don't believe that. Their kids hear the comments and they have absorbed this idea. It may be out of balance from reality, but whatever it is, for whatever reason, they believe that they can't make a life that they want in Roslyn. And I often say to them, don't worry about it, man. Most of us will be dead or in a nursing home by the time you do anything. So it's not a thing.
Just come back eventually.
Just come back. You know, come back. Buy your house while you're in that other place. Buy your house, you know, instead of some person who's just going to use it for a hunting lodge. Buy your house and then just wait for us to die and then come back. You know, because, you know, there's hope for you. You know,
that's a method I had never heard before to get kids to come back.
It's like, don't worry about it. And keep in contact with all of your alumni and friends who also moved and probably thinking the same thing you're thinking. If all of you come back, we'll have to like buy a cornfield to make a new, you know, extend Roslyn, you know?
Right.
So I'm seeing opportunity where other people may not. But the get to the story of the existence of museum. We had a lot of conversations about, you know, how to build a town and stuff like that. And we did surveys because I went to a lot of meetings and economic development things. And again, because of that community organizing and also having been an investigative reporter, so looking underneath the hood of like, well, what are all of these things happening and how do these stories come together?
Asking why on a couple of things.
Asking why. And then holding people accountable for what they say. So one example of that is I had gone to lots of meetings and they had, you know, they put out all of these, you know, grand plans of how to build your town because people were getting money to come and be consultants of how to save the small town and stuff like that, towns and stuff. So I've been to all of these meetings, a whole bunch of meetings anyway. So we had been doing all the things that I get all these papers and plans and come back. We were doing, kids were going out and doing surveys in the community. How many people need jobs? How many, you know, and all this stuff. We did all those things. We even put it in like little folders and made little publications and stuff like that. Well, it wasn't happening for us. And we had been we're working on this thing for like a couple of years. So what I did is I went around to all of those people who were like, you know, Governor's Office of Economic Development, bankers who had been on these various committees, university professors at SDSU and people who were like, because it's a land grant institution. I got all them people together who had been advising us and we invited them to a meeting with all of the town people. We said, here's all the stuff we've been doing. These are the things you guys said. And this is not working. Just so you know, you know, whatever you were saying, we think we've done it. What was it that we didn't do that in all of these things? Here's the papers that you guys
put out. You gave me a blueprint. We followed it.
We followed the blueprint, but you told us it was going to be a skyscraper. We're seeing a teepee, you know, so how, you know, what's going on here? So I always remember this guy said, well, to put it bluntly, Microsoft is not going to come here. You guys don't have anything to offer people. You don't have a football stadium or anything like that. And, you know, people are not going to, you know, who are not from here are not going to want to come to Roslyn. No, people are not going to want to come to Roslyn and sort of set up shop because, you know, there are all kinds of things like, well, where are people going to live and all of these things. You don't have the infrastructure, basically.
Right. The details.
That's right. But I said, oh, that's interesting. I don't see that anywhere in any of these papers that you guys put out that these plans are for people who have 20,000 people or more.
Right. Here's a limitation list.
Here's a limitation. Apply. Do not apply. This is not for you. You know, in fact, we hope that you go away. You know, well, that's not what we're working at. So all of these plans, basically, according to what you're saying, this is so that the bigger towns can survive at our expense. But they did say, if you're going to succeed, you know, you're going to have one people who live in your town because people are not going to likely want to come here and, quote, save your town.
Right.
And then two, whatever you come up with is going to have to be really different because otherwise the bigger towns will see what you're doing and eat your lunch, right? Because right. And you nobody will ever know the town that they took the business that you
started. They took your idea.
They took your idea. So you're gonna have to do something that's really interesting. So what do you have in your town that you think, or who do you have in your town that could do something like that? And everybody
like this. Yeah, he's different. You know, what do you have different? That guy over there, he's kind of different. He does something none of us do. You know, we don't even understand, like, actually what he does, you know. But we know he's different, you know. And since I had been, like, really on my soapbox saying we have to think out of the box, do something different, like, try, you know, suddenly I felt like, oh, I kind of dug my hole here. Because I, you know, my whole business really at that time, before that, the Vinegar Museum, I was traveling all the time, you know. And, you know, because my business was outside of Roslyn. And I had understood that that's the way it was going to be.
Right.
So the idea of having to stay in Roslyn or do something in Roslyn, it was like, oh, I have to really restructure how I interact with my clients, you know, because, you know, whatever I do, if I'm going to be the person that does it, I've never done a business where you sit in a shop. I'm not a shopkeeper kind of guy.
You know? Felt tied down all of a sudden to a...
That's right. It was almost like I got married and got a dog, you know. It's like, so now I have to be there all the time, you know. So I felt like, okay, what would that feel like? How would I do that? How long could I do that? You know, it's like, you know, it's not, I haven't done that since I was like, I haven't like had that kind of lifestyle since I was like 18, you know? So because even when I was in radio, I was always traveling. I was always going someplace doing something, you know? So I said, okay, I'm not going to say to these people no, because that just felt too hypocritical for myself. But whatever they thought, I couldn't think of myself in a positive way if I say, hey, yeah, everybody do this, but not me, you do. That always seemed so phony when other people did it, and I couldn't be that guy. So I said, okay, next couple of days I'm out here, I'm going to Japan, but while I'm there, I will think about this problem. When I come back, I'll tell you what I can do, and if it works for you, then let's try something. So I got to thinking about it, and I start with problems. When I start trying to do something, I start with what is the problem. If I don't diagnose the problem, then I can't really find a remedy. Mm-hmm. If I don't understand what I have to work with, I can imagine all kinds of things. But if my resources are not there, then that's just like a cocktail talk. Mm-hmm. So when I looked at it, I thought, well, what's missing in the town is the belief, is our kids believing that this can be a life for them, to be proud of this town and to have a sense of connectedness to the town, and to have something that they feel like Roslyn isn't a place that you escape from.
Right. You know,
it's a place where you can build something. So underneath all of that, you have to have something in the town that when you say Roslyn, you can attach something else to it. We have to get on the map, so to speak.
Right.
So then I say, okay, well, what do I have to work with? Well, one, I have a motivated population. That is the most valuable thing that you can have.
I was going to say that. That's kind of the biggest number one thing you need to have, is enough people to care about the same thing that you do.
Exactly. And if you have a motivated population, then what are the other hard resources you need? Well, you need a place. Well, we do have this one building that was built by the WPA. People use it maybe sometime for graduation or a wedding reception, but otherwise the place is sitting there crumbling. Okay, so we got a potential place. And then what would we do? Well, I just happen to have a living room full of vinegar that people have been sending me for years, and that I should have threw out, but it's all sitting there. And they usually send me at least a sample or two, one to sample, you know, it just sort of like the customary thing, send two bottles, right?
Okay.
So I got all this vinegar, and I had written a textbook. So I had all of these facts and figures and pictures that I had gotten and collected from, you know, to make the textbook. I had still had the, you know, like the negatives and the micrographs and stuff like that. I had all this stuff. And it just said Vinegar Museum, you know, you're like, what else would you do with all this stuff, but except put it in a museum, you know?
Right.
And if you have people that will help you and you got a building, and nobody else has that, you know, why not do that, you know? So I thought about the building and made some like rough diagrams, and I came back and I presented it to people, and they looked at me like, okay.
We knew this guy was
but not that different, you know.
So, but of course, I had no idea of what to, you know, how do you make a vineyard, any kind of museum, really? Mm-hmm. I had hardly even gone to museums, let alone run one. I had no idea. And I knew that we had to have some kind of cash flow because, you know, I'm not rich and, you know, there had to be some way to kind of pay for these things. You know, it's going to have some cost, even if the city lets us use the building. It's going to have costs, you know.
Right.
You got upkeep, power, and power, all kinds of. That's just right. I mean, there's just costs, you know, that there's going to cost. You can keep the cost down, but one, you need to turn it into a museum first of all, because it's not a museum yet, and you just can't say it's a museum. At least you have to have a sign that says museum. Hey, science costs money. Exactly. So if nothing else, we got to get that sign up, you know. Right. But because I had been going to all of these meetings leading up to this, then I had made a relationship. How are you doing on time?
We're good.
Okay.
Yeah.
So because I had been, you know, going to all of these economic development meetings and stuff like that, well, I had met all of these people in the state all around, you know, from the governor's office and legislators and state representatives and senators and people like all those people, all the important people,
right.
You know, so I've been meeting all of those people, you know, at these meetings and listening to their rap and sort of like figuring out who they are and what they do and stuff like that. So I was kind of in a position to do it. And another kind of interesting personality quirk is I don't mind asking people, you know, questions. And everybody to me is at eye level. If you ain't at eye level, you ain't. I mean, I don't care if you have this title and stuff. Okay, you know, I don't disrespect you, but I'm not coming in thinking that you're the cat's meow, you know, because I've been around people like that too long to know that they do the same things other people do, you know. I mean, and they have the same needs. The fundamental needs are all the same,
right.
You know. So, I was well positioned, and my biggest motivation was at that time, these people treated me like family from the get-go.
The people in Roslyn?
And the people in Roslyn. I cannot leave them. I cannot walk away from them. And I see that the same kind of games that were played on people in the neighborhood that I grew up in that pushed us out, those things are being played on these people. Knowing that, how can I not help them? How can I, you know, it's not like I'm the cat's meow and I know all the answers, but I've been through the battle before and they haven't. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe their grandparents during the Depression and stuff like that, but this is a whole new level of game playing that people are doing. They're playing, and I can see that they're playing the same games on these people that they played on us. And beside, I start to recognize that a lot of the sociology of Roslyn was not too much different than the sociology of the neighborhood I grew up in. You change their name from Johnson to Bjornson, and you got the same people. You know, they you know, everything from, you know, their attachment to church and school and their, you know, sort of like uneasiness with let's say, they'll go to the football game, but if you have the science fair, they're looking at their watch, you know.
Right.
That was the same. That was the same attitude, you know, that was the same kind of foibles. So from the good points and the bad points and all the foibles, human things, I really felt a connection to the people that I live with. Mm-hmm. And I would feel cheap, I would say. I don't know that I could not wake up in the morning and feel cheap if I say, okay, well, I could go anywhere. Why am I living here? You know, maybe I just go settle in Japan, you know, or go back to San Francisco. I mean, that was easy enough to do. Mm-hmm. I couldn't do it. You know, I mean, and think of myself in some kind of positive way, you know, not after like people have like treated me like family. So now I'm going to walk away.
It was like leaving home.
Yeah. Yeah. And well, it also leaving home, knowing that somebody's just going to come back behind me and destroy them. You know, maybe I'm the last Mohican, but I, you know, maybe there's only two of us or one of us left standing, but I figure I would feel better being the last person to turn out the lights in Roslyn than to walk away from my neighbors knowing that they're being attacked.
Right.
You know, so it just wasn't an option for me. So it wasn't that I was a good guy. It's just, I couuln't live with myself.
I think that makes you a good guy.
Yeah. I mean, but you know, I mean, it's like, to me, that's like baseline. That's like, well, what else could I be, really? You know, what else, what other kind of person could I be? So anyway, the community thought, well, okay, well, if you say so, you know, they literally, you know, there were people who like say, well, we don't know what you're doing, man, but, you know, like, just tell us what you want us to do. I mean, they literally said that, you know.
Fix it.
And we'll help you. And they didn't just shift it to me. Like some people say, oh yeah, everybody, if you do it, then everybody else comes and eat if you cook the food. But no, they were there. You know, if I remember this one example, I was at coffee and I say, you know, I need to put up a sign. And after coffee, within 20 minutes after coffee, there were people with payloaders and all kinds of things standing around just saying, well, tell us what to do. And you had people who knew how to hang stuff and knew how to drill holes in walls and brick walls and stuff. And I just said, I need this sign this up higher this way. Done. You know, I had kids who would come in when I was like, I'm the kind of person that if like when I was doing the remodeling of the interior and I knew what I want, I'm the kind of person who wakes up or goes to bed and wakes up doing workflow models. Okay. Mm-hmm. The problem is if I don't know who I'm working with, I can't make a workflow model that includes people that I don't understand their skill level. The only person who I know their skill level is me, you know, and it's not to say I have all the skills. You know, I was fortunate enough to have a father who did lots of different things and took me along with me and taught me. And, you know, everything from plumbing to electrical and stuff like that. I grew up doing that as a middle schooler and high schooler. So I had some idea of what I needed to do. Even if I needed a contractor to do it, I knew what I needed to get done. And things like the floors, well, we used to do ballroom floors as, you know, on the weekends in the two major dance clubs in San Francisco. So if there was something I knew how to take glass wax off and put real wax on. And they had like, they hadn't taken the glass wax off of that floor for probably 30 years because it was like, whoa, this is you got a glass wax problem here. And in fact, it was comical because many of the people didn't know what glass wax was, you know. But I could look at it and say, that's the overaccumulation of glass wax. That's a job for me. I can do that. Even if we don't do a museum, I know how to take the glass wax off. Now I just up the value of this place.
Yeah.
But, you know, so it was you know, taking that off. And the other thing is, knowing that there are lots of things I don't know, I joined the South Dakota Museum Association and I went to every meeting and I created relationships and I asked people about how they do it, how high you hang this stuff. And then I added some things I knew about retail from working in radio and doing merchandising things and just going to places, you know, there was the business. So I could add what the museum people knew, you know, taught me and what I had brought in terms of retail from talking to retailers and stuff. But the most important thing is I had spent 10 years in radio and TV and I knew promotion. You know, if I knew nothing, even if I didn't know vinegar, I knew promotion. So I was able to call people, send out press releases and actually get them answers. So we got, you know, like you can see in the museum, we have like articles from like Bon Appetit, New York Times, before we ever even opened, the Korean Broadcasting Company came to Roslyn to do a story on us.
Wow.
You know, and
that's
they went
really
in,
cool.
Yeah, yeah. And they went and interviewed the kids and they sent us a tape back and the kids could see themselves on Korean TV, you know. So it was like golden. It was like, okay, this is the life, man. So it's like, okay, well, let's try this thing. If it don't work out, look, it's a little town and, you know, it's in the middle of, you know, of a road that doesn't go to very many places. So if it works, the people say, wow, it's amazing. If it doesn't work, they say, well, it's a vinegar museum in a small town. What do you expect? You know, okay. So we were in a no-lose position with starting something. So we said, okay, let's go for it, you know. And since I understood like how to do a lot of that refurbishing stuff inexpensively, and I have to say that I had some old timers between Roslyn and Webster, I could go to some of the old timers and say, hey, look, I'm trying to do this. I don't need to buy this piece of equipment. Can you do this for me? They cut things out and they made things for me to make the shelves and stuff like that. And we didn't have enough walls for the museum. So I had to design freestanding walls and I got people to make the stuff. And those walls are still standing 20 years later, you know, they may still be there when the building falls down, you know, but the thing is, it's like that kind of collaborative work allowed us to make the museum. So, you know, I'm often the kind of figurehead because people see me and because also I was promoting the thing and going around. I actually did a coast to coast thing on the Yellowstone Trail to promote the Vinegar Museum, you know?
Yeah.
So people know my face, but I'm not the real power behind it. It's the community.
You know, though, I feel like I've heard stories where someone will have a good idea like what you had, mm-hmm. and then they say, okay, well, I gave you the idea, you guys can go work on it. And I think that's kind of where you have a disconnect or a program or a project might kind of fall apart because, you know, there almost needs to be more continued buy-in from the person whose idea it was. You can't just contribute the idea and walk away. And so I think that, I don't know, more than anything, the fact that you were working on the glass wax floors and everything else is really, you know, a sign of that you cared as much as everybody else did and you weren't just looking for an idea to throw at them and then walk away.
Yeah. Well, I think that's important. But I think it's a matter of self-respect. You know, if a person's going to throw out an idea, but you don't know anything about it, how do you know if the damn thing is going to work? You know,
right.
Those moments of like where you know, you're working in the museum and doing a shelf and, you know, you're building something. And, you know, I'm really sort of like focused when I do stuff like that to the point that I can feel antisocial because I can't talk to you because I have ideas suspended in my head. I don't want to turn to talk to you because if I do, I'll forget something.
They're going to float away.
But there would be kids who would hear me in there and they would come in. And I can remember I had to almost like break up what seemed to be going to be a fight. Well, who gets to hold the hammer? You know, it's like, because they wanted to be, you know, we want to be a part of this, you know? And I had that kind of like from young kids to old people in the town, you know? I mean, you always have the cave people, citizens against virtually everything. You always have some of them, you know, but they don't count really. You just need the people who are passionate about saying, hey, we don't even know if it's going to work, but it's something, you know, we know what we're doing now is not working. And if there's going to be some energy, let's all go and do this together. We're all this one community. Those are the people that you need. The other people who don't care or they don't want it to happen, those are not the people you need to have long conversations with because if they don't get it, there's nothing that can save them that I have to give. Now, there's probably somebody else who knows what to do with people like that. I'm not one of those guys, you know? It's like if you come to me and you're motivated and you say, hey, brother, I'm trying to do this. I'm trying to help myself or I'm trying to help this brother over here or this sister over here, then you have my attention. And then I will see if there's resources in my bag that I can lend to you. But if you come to me for like, I don't want to do anything and I don't want anybody else to do anything and the world is going to hell in a handbasket, you might be right, but homie ain't feeling it.
Can't do anything about that.
I can't do anything for you because I can't do anything for the program that you have. I still love you. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But there's nothing I can do for you. I mean, I can sit there and listen to you, but there's really nothing I can do for you or with you. So I'm going to be doing this other thing. And besides, I'm busy doing this other thing that I don't want to do. So I don't have no time for you. So when I was surrounded by, you know, as I was surrounded by people who did want to do something and would like contribute ideas. And if they had any resources, at least you're trying. And I want to be a part of that.
I respect that at least you're
trying. Doesn't get any better than that. And I want to be a part of that. Doesn't get any better than that. That's all you can expect from people, especially when you're part of the vinegar world. You're creating a museum, and none of those people ever did a museum either. But they don't even have the benefit of having gone to all of those museum meetings and going to the state tourism conferences and listening to people talk about what they're doing and making those contacts. They don't have any of that, but they're just following. They're, okay, you're trying to do it. We'll go with you.
Man. We trust you.
We trust you, and let's go. Okay, well, you know, it doesn't. You just think, okay, I really wish some of them would come to some of these conferences with me, because despite what people may think, I'm mortal, you know, I'm going to die. You know, it's like, contrary to rumors, I am going to die. And it's like, okay, I would like some other people, especially our young people, even if you're not going to stay in Roslyn, part of the reason for doing a museum is that it's a place for you. You can come and watch how you can play with the cash register. You can come and interact with customers. You can come and we can talk about, you know, at your leisure. I'm going to be here from these hours. And if I don't have customers in the museum, feel free to come in and I can talk to you about marketing programs, because I did marketing programs. I can talk to you about radio promotion and how to write a press release and why people pick up on this press release, but they don't publish this one. I can talk to you about the music world, and I can tell you why you don't buy that radio ad, but you might want to buy this one. I can tell you why you should get a business card before you spend a dime on advertising. I can tell you all of that stuff because I know it backwards and forwards, right? That's a thing that I can bring, and the museum positioned me to be able to offer that to young people at their leisure. And I had young people would often come in and sit down and spend hours talking to me about those things. Okay, it worked. Even if we don't sell any vinegar, you know, the plan is working. And because I go around the state speaking at universities on various things, I've had a number of cases where the professors had said, you know, the Vinegar Museum, you'd be surprised how much it means. She said, I remember this one teacher said, every year I have a class of about 200 students in this seminar class. And she said, and every year, you know, do you have freshmen people come in? And we ask people to, you know, to introduce themselves and say where they're from, because, you know, being at USD, their kids come from every place. And she said, it was always amazing when the kids, you know, a kid from Roslyn will come and they will say, you know, I'm Frank from Roslyn. And somebody else in the class will say, oh, that's where the Vinegar Museum is. You said, see this kid like light up like a neon sign. Wow, somebody knows Roslyn.
That's my home.
That's right. People know us. And then for them to pick up a Rand McNally, a Michelin map, open it up and see the Vinegar Museum on that map. That's a thing. That's a thing. You know, that's worth it to me to be able to put their town on the map and therefore put them on the map. Now, wherever you go, you can say, well, I come from this place and our claim to fame is we have a vinegar museum. And people go, what? Nah. Yes, we have a vinegar
museum. An international
vinegar museum. And if you don't believe me, just watch. You know, here's the map. See that right there? That's Roslyn. There's a vinegar museum. In fact, the vinegar museum has bigger print than Roslyn. And so you can see it, you know. Mm-hmm. That's a thing, you know. That's a reason to start something. And that's the reason to start the vinegar museum. It isn't really about selling vinegar. You know, you can do it in much cheaper ways than that. But the fact that it gives something to the spirit of the people who want to be involved in it, you know. And of course, you always, as I said, you know, you always find people who are like, whatever you start, you know, look, people killed Jesus Christ, you know, so you shouldn't be surprised that everybody doesn't go along with whatever program you have, you know.
Yeah.
So, but there are people who get it. And those are the people that count. And those are the people that I try to improve their lives.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I know earlier we talked a little bit about like everything costs money, and the sign costs money, and keeping it running costs money. And is there something that you guys have done, or a way you found around costs, or how does the museum keep itself running at this point financially?
Okay. So when I started the museum, people offered money, but I didn't know where it was, and I was skittish about it. So what I felt like was, and the other thing is, I don't think people should let money be their master. We should try to do everything we can without money. That means, because, you know, money basically is a way to represent resources and talent, you know, things that people can do. That, you know, it's goods and services. You know, either you're going to bring a thing or you bring something that you do. You take that away, you don't have an economy. You take goods and services away, you don't have an economy. So everything, money just represents some level of value to those goods and services. So if you have people who know how to do things, you don't have to hire that out if they will come and do it for you, if they have a buy-in. As one of my early mentors said, if people trust each other, you don't need money. Because mm-hmm. if I know that if I get up, if anybody needs something in the town and I can do it, and I'm always preparing myself to help other people in the town, and our currency is, I help you because I have the full expectation that if I need anything, if it's available, somebody is going to provide it for me. Mm-hmm. Then why do I need money? If all my needs are, all the needs that is available is taken care of, I don't really need it. So I kind of, that's always in the back of my head. So I don't start with how much money can I get and what can I do with it? I start with what do we need to get done and what's the least amount of money that we need to raise to do it. So I operated on the fact that I personally could do, probably come up with a grand or $2,000 for this, for to put all of this together. What could I do with $2,000 or $3,000? Mm-hmm. So I built what was the original Vinegar Museum around the concept of do more with less.
Okay.
So it turned out that I didn't even need the couple thousand. I need about $500-$600, you know, and some motivated people to help me, mm-hmm. right? So because the building was already standing, to fix the floors was really a matter of renting the equipment that I needed for 2 or 3 days and planning that out. The varnish and stuff was, you know, that you needed to redo the floor. We're talking about at that time, $50-$60, mm-hmm. you know. And maybe another $50-$60 for equipment like mops and stuff like that, and all the little things like that. Many of which I had because I had refurbished my house, so I already had a lot of that stuff, you know, ladders and stuff like that. So
you really decluttered with this project, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right. I got all kinds of stuff. In fact, some people. I remember this. I had a friend of mine, from Japan. Her parents came to America, and they came. Her mother and father came to visit me, and the mother walked in and she said, "Lawrence, you need some furniture." And then we went. I took them as part of like their sort of like tour of South Dakota. I took them to an auction because they in Japan they would never have something like that, or even if they had it, they wouldn't be the kind of people who would go. You know, because they're like people from Tokyo, they would never go to an auction. So I took them to one of these country auctions, and I heard the mother say to the father, you know, we need to buy Lawrence some furniture. So yeah, I got rid of a lot of stuff. So I basically we did it pretty much, we put the thing together. I knew people in the because I'd written a book on vinegar, I knew all kinds of people in vinegar. So I could call those people and say, hey, I need some vinegar. If you want to have your vinegar in my museum. And suddenly I had all kinds of vinegar. So I had the main thing. I had a friend who in Japan, she actually bought and sent like all kinds of stuff about Japanese vinegar, including a large one of those clay pots that they make vinegar in. That's the traditional pots that you make vinegar in, traditional vinegar making in Japan, not the factories.
I have to admit, I am not well versed on vinegar making.
Okay, so
I have to get into it one time.
Okay, yeah. But okay, so in the traditional way that you make vinegar in Japan, they use these clay pots and they make it out of brown rice. They call it gemaisu. And so in this case, it's brown rice, barley, and wheat. Okay. And then they make it all together, and they use these clay pots that they're black.
Okay.
And so they absorb heat. Okay. from the black glaze on the pots. And she bought one of those and shipped it to America for her contribution to making this thing happen. So it's nice if you know people, you can say, hey, I'm doing this thing. Can you help me?
Right.
You know, and they, in fact, she sent us a whole box of, a big box of candy that was made from this brown rice, traditional brown rice vinegar that we sold actually. And that helped to finance, you know, but we had all kinds of people help like that. You know, I could call people who knew people and, you know, get promotion, and we did well. Okay. My original idea was, look, 3 to 5 years and get it started, show people how to do it. And then we decide if we're going to do it or not. If you guys are in, good, but I have to get back to my business because I'm basically shutting down my business for 3 to 5 years to make this happen.
Right.
I can't do, I don't see that's going to work for any.
You're not a big believer in money, but you do need.
And at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also it was my life. You know, I was a person who was always traveling, and my business travel was in the summer. That's when, because that overlapped much of the places where people were making the vinegar that I had clients, their vinegar making season was in the summer.
Mm.
So if I was going to travel to go see them, like when they start the vinegar process or when they're in it or when they were having problems, I had to be available to go and see them at the time when they needed me. The rest of the year, in that wintertime, the vinegar is resting. It's not doing anything. That's not when you're going to have the problems with the vinegar. You're going to have the problems and when you're starting the fermentation and during the time and at the end. Once it's fermented and you filter it in and you put it in bottles, if it's something wrong, it's just too late, you know.
Right.
So now you're just aging it. And if you set it up right, you know, most, there might be some things, you know, to do, but most of the time it wasn't anything to do. So that overlapped. So I wasn't planning to do that. Yeah. And besides, I'm not a shopkeeper. It's not my personality to sit in a shop and count money. You know, that's just not me, you know? So at some point I said, you know, after I had done it, actually at that point, like 9 years, I said to the community, hey, look, you know, either you guys are going to take this over or I'm going to shut it down because, you know, I want to do something else, you know, I mean, and I knew that as long as I did it, nobody would step up because it was like pushing me out.
Mm-hmm.
I psychologically, you know, you could feel that, you know, even so it didn't really, I don't think that people really considered doing it because it was like, that's Lawrence's place.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it doesn't even come up. It doesn't rise to the level. It was only when I said, either you guys are going to take it over, or I'm going to shut it down. Then people, oh, no. Don't shut it down. Because now there are people who recognize the value of it, right, to their community. They wanted to keep it going. So they formed a community and they formed a committee and they kind of sort of like, through it, they say, okay, look, you know, we're not Lawrence. We, you know, like, you know, we live differently, but we know that this thing needs money. And he really should have asked us for money, but he didn't, you know. he, you know, we should have, and I wouldn't take it. Even when people offer, they say, well, don't you need, I don't need any money, because I think we should try to keep money out of these kind of projects. As far as like the people who have interest, they should bring heart more than money. The thing has to make money, but the point isn't to make money. And if you make money the end goal, you will do things a lot different than the end goal is to have your community feel like they own something. That's two different approaches to business.
Right.
I saw that the value of the thing was in having the community feel that they own something that they could be proud of. It wasn't in the bottom line. So my approach to the museum was different than even my business, mm-hmm. you know? So, but they're kind of like coming at it from a different, not that they, that wasn't important to them too, but they recognize that, okay, we don't have all these cost cutting things. You know, we don't have all these little tricks that we can do. And that was pretty obvious because most people didn't know and have those same contacts. So it wasn't reasonable to expect that they could do that. So they had to approach it in a different way. So they raise some money. And that's what is referred to as an endowment.
Okay.
Is that they raised a pool of money to have, like, we don't know how much money we need, but we, if we're going to order vinegar, instead of doing it like Lawrence did, it's like, I'll sell this vinegar. And when I get this money from this vinegar, I'll order some more. We could do better if we ordered a greater amount of vinegar, but we need a pool of money to take advantage of doing that. So that's what's referred to as an endowment. It isn't like somebody said, hey, you know, here's $100,000 and let's make the museum. It was like sweat equity kind of thing.
Okay.
And then all the people who made up this committee, they're still kind of running it. And they kind of set the rules. So I completely turned the thing over. In fact, I in the summertime when they were gone for a couple of years, I went to Alaska. So because I wanted to be completely, you know, I figure, okay, you guys know what, you know, you've been coming and helping me with this museum for years now. You know how to run it. But if I stay here,
I'll run it.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the whole idea, and I wanted it to be very clear that I wanted them to own it. It never was a project for me. I never wanted a museum. The thing was built for the community. And so I figure if the community at this point, if they don't see a value in it, then it should die, you know? And, you know, because it was never for me. It's not, you know, even when the city offered, they said, well, why don't we sell you this building for $1? I said, I don't want it because I don't need this. I'm not building an empire. I don't have heirs.
Vinegar empire.
Yeah, you know what I mean? So I feel like it took the best path because people stepped up. They found a value in it. They run it. They, you know, I am now slowly starting to show up at meetings, but I make a point to say, you guys decide if you find something that you want to do, but you don't think you can or you don't know how, before you give up, call me. Because I still know people. I'm still doing things. I still, you know, example, we're going to have a vinegar festival.
Okay.
And the vinegar festival is always the Saturday before Father's Day. We used to say try to say the third Saturday, but then it's hard to count which Saturday is the third, you know, and then weekends fall in funny places. So we just aim at the Saturday. Wherever Father's Day is, that's on a Sunday, we're the Saturday before.
Okay.
That's concise. So the Vinegar Museum opens in the beginning of June, goes through July and August. It's what we normally think of in South Dakota as pretty much the tourist season. Once you get past August, September could be good.
It's a little dicey.
It could be dicey. So, and also it was around, originally it was around when the teachers were available, because a lot of the teachers were the people who helped us out during the year.
Okay. Right. That makes sense.
And also the kids, you know, the kids were, you know, so it's after the kids go back to school, whatever you say, a lot of tourist season is over because people have to go and take care of their kids and their, you know, and maybe on the weekend something had happened, but for the rest of the week, kids are in school, people are busy, you know, life goes back to whatever,
right.
You know, whatever people call normal. So then we have the Vinegar Festival on that Saturday before Father's Day. The museum opened from the beginning of July, beginning of June to the end of August.
Okay.
And I think it's at Labor Day or at the end of August, whatever holiday that okay. is, that's usually the last day. So if it runs into September, it does. And if it doesn't, then, you know. But the other thing is, if people want a tour and they have, let's say, a group that wants to see it, if we have people who are in town, we'll open it for them. Because one of the things that we managed to do, or the group, the new group that took over and had better financial responsibilities. One of the things that they managed to do was they raised enough money that they put geothermal in that building. Mm. And so now it's not a big, we used to have to take all the vinegar out every year to keep it from freezing. Mm. Otherwise we'd have to pay to keep it. Now we can keep the visit vinegars in there because it doesn't cost us that much because we have geothermal. Well,
that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's amazing, you know. And so if we it doesn't cost us a whole bunch of money to warm up the museum, you know, now that we have the geothermal. So if people want to come, that, you know, they need to call us and they can go on the website, you know, at Vinegar International Vinegar Museum.com. And then they can contact us from, you know, from that website by phone or by email or whatever they're, you know, by mail,
snail mail. All the ways.
All the ways. Yes, right. The usual, you know, if people are available, then we'll open up for, especially for groups, if, you know, groups are want to come. But the rest of the time, you know, we don't have enough people coming that makes sense to have somebody right. sit in there.
Yeah. Right. Well, thank you, Lawrence. It's been fantastic talking to you. I feel like I've learned so much.
Well, it's been fun to, you know, having this time with you, Kara. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you.
Home Starts Here is a podcast production by the South Dakota State University Extension Community Vitality Team. We look forward to releasing future episodes for you, and if you want to learn more about our programs focusing on creating vibrant places, energizing leaders, and strengthening businesses, visit our website today at extension.sdstate.edu/community.